ruling puts the birthright citizenship issue on a fast track to return to the Supreme Court. For KPFA News, I'm Dahlia Lozier.
I'm Teresa Wersbianska for Pacifica Radio.
At 89.3 FM, this is member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Channel in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, July 11th, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we continue to explore how immigrants in the U.S. continue to be at the mercy of white nationalists, from the Trump administration all the way down to ICE and all the way up to the Supreme Court as well. And so with us on the show today, once again, is Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. He has a litany of Substack articles, and he's been very busy this past July in particular. Arturo Dominguez, welcome back to the show.
Man, I appreciate being here. It's always fun, and I'm really looking forward to this one. There's been a lot going on.
Oh, absolutely. And while most of our conversations begin with some degree of doom and gloom, I want to start off by talking about the No Kings demonstrations that took place throughout the country and through various parts of the world last month. I'm curious to get your thoughts on last month's No Kings demonstrations throughout the country and how it contrasts to Trump's military parade here in Washington, his military parade slash quinceañera, however you want to call it. But yeah, I want to get your thoughts on the demonstrations that we saw, you know, nationwide, because I know there were quite a few over in Texas alone as well, right?
Yeah, there was. There was some tracker. They were keeping track of protests in every state. And I think Texas had like 71. But, you know, there was a few, like, for example, here in Houston, like in the outskirts, where it's just a couple people standing on a corner, you know, holding signs. They weren't very big. But The big one, you know, downtown Houston was good size. All the ones I saw in all the cities seemed like they were a huge success. And as far as trying to take attention away from that military parade, they did it.
Yes.
They forced news media to focus on the protests. And I know that the parade was live streamed by a lot of outlets online, and I'm sure it was televised. I wasn't really paying attention to that part too much, but I did notice the turnout was terrible. They had issues at the parade. I saw a clip or something where they were supposed to fly some drones, but the drones ran out of batteries before the parade started, so they had to walk and holding the drones. I don't know. It was the whole thing was dumb to begin with. But yeah, you know, in Trump's mind, he was probably thinking, you know, you see the parades from like North Korea or Russia, and they're all, you know, got the tight formation and the super high, you know, legs going when they're walking. I imagine Trump was expecting something along those lines, but that's just not how we do it here. So what he got is what you get in the U.S. We don't have that history and that culture of parading our military might everywhere, you know? So I don't necessarily really get what Trump's goal was with that. But getting back to the No Kings thing, I think they did a hell of a job, you know, shutting that down. You know, I take some issue with how it was organized only because you have that many people gathering together in the country and around the world, but particularly in the United States, I feel like there should have been some more organizing going on, some sort of a plan for what comes after the protest. Okay, so they wanted to send Trump a message. He got the message, right? The country's angry with him. His poll numbers are in the toilet, right? They're tanking with independents, with, you know, a lot of swing voters, some of his own supporters, like the farmer who was crying on TV. You see that. And what was really the plan with the protest? What was the actual message that was supposed to be sent? And aside from telling, you know, giving Trump the bird, I'm not exactly sure what the message is. This was an opportunity for local communities, you know, people in their local communities. Like, I don't know, you know, I'm sure you've been to Latino protests, right? And just like Black people do this too. I've been to some Black protests, and they organize and they prepare for what's coming. And in this situation, you know that there's going to be people that are hungry, you know, because of all these attacks on Medicaid and food stamps and all these things. And, you know, there's going to be immigrant families that are struggling because maybe their breadwinner got taken by ICE. And now, you know, they're two steps from being on the street. I just don't see any of that happening at the No Kings protest. And while I call it a success, I do so reluctantly just because there's no real plan for what comes after. You know, this was an opportunity for Democrats in particular to get a message of quote unquote resistance out there. And I just didn't see that either. You know, I saw Jamie Raskin. He's asking people if they want to fight back. Do you want to live in a gangster state, or do you want free speech in America? You know, he said something about, we can't be the founding fathers from the 18th century, but we can be the founding fighters of the 21st century. But what exactly is the fight? The struggle that I have, there are a lot of Democrats, right? So I'm not trying to bash individual Democrats here. There are a lot of Democrats that are doing a lot of stuff that are trying, you know, but Democrats right now should look like what Republicans look like under Kevin McCarthy, under Mitch McConnell, unified, right? So when Al Green wanted to, he introduced articles of impeachment for the illegal bombing of Iran. You know, Democrats, I felt like, should have coalesced around him. Sure, it was just a procedural thing, right? I didn't expect it to get very far. But I didn't expect most Democrats to vote with Republicans either against Al Green. Al Green had once said, and this stuck with me and it still does to this day, sometimes you know, and I'm paraphrasing, sometimes you know that you're not going to win the fight, but you fight anyway, because somebody has to. Somebody has to give them resistance. And, you know, you push as far as you can and you pave the way as far as you can go so that somebody else can come behind you and pick up where you left off. You know, that's how you achieve anything in terms of civil rights or any kind of rights. And I just don't see that coming from Democrats. I didn't see that with the No Kings protest. I think that with the No Kings protest, for me, it's a disappointment to not have any kind of really anything. The only things I've seen regarding actions post-protest were continued protests. There's an upcoming one in a few days for John Lewis. And then, you know, boycotts. But I didn't see a list of who to boycott and why, you know? So it doesn't seem like post-protest action was really thought out at all. And when you consider that this was put together by the 5051 people, they had, you know, backing from the ACLU and MoveOn.org. Those are experienced organizations that should have had at least someone with an idea of, let's try to see what we can do after this protest. Get all these people together, coalesce around something, even if it's as little as just do something in your local community, you know, to help, to have stuff ready for a migrant family who might need food or might need, you know, take their kid to the doctor, you know, if they lost their breadwinner. There's so many things that could have been done. And the opportunity, they say something like 15 million people showed up for the protest. I think that's a huge missed opportunity to not have a unified message about something. And I'm not so sure that I didn't get any message like that from that protest. And I think it's a wasted opportunity, you know.
On the local level here in Washington, at least here in Washington, I think it was great because it certainly dwarfed the crowd that showed up for Trump's little military fascist parade there. And it's also quite amusing to me that there were images of Trump and other officials just bored out of their minds watching that whole parade, while people here in Washington and various other parts throughout the country seem pretty unified in their contempt for the Trump administration. My only critique of the No Kings demonstration, I would say, is the name itself, No Kings. I would take it a step further and say no oligarchs or no billionaires, because to do so would bring greater awareness to the issue of class, which is at the center of not only Trump's push to this big, beautiful bill that we've been hearing about, even as we have this conversation right now. It seems like the Senate might pass it. So while Trump may have gotten the message of the No Kings demonstration, the House of Representatives and the Senate did not. And so, yeah, there should be more to be done after the huge demonstrations. And that's where the real challenge is when it comes to grassroots activism. You know, we don't want to be entirely doom and gloom over all of it, but yeah, more needs to be done after the fact. Now, you've written in your article in your Substack page on June 12th, I believe, breaking down the catch-22 that the Trump administration has created for migrants this year. Could you break down how courthouses have now become the new and popular avenue to disappearing people? You know, yeah, we got to say it, disappearing people who are otherwise following the legal system correctly. I'm hoping you could break this down because, you know, not too many people know what an NTA is, notice to appear from the court, but this is worth mentioning with regards to, as I describe, a catch-22 that's been developed.
Right. So, you know, we've all seen the videos of migrants going to court, the DOJ dismisses their case, and ICE agents are standing there waiting, and they take them into custody. At the beginning of June, Homeland Security decided that they were going to start issuing notices to appear in court. And essentially, they're using those notices to appear as bait. You know, you get somebody to go to court, you're not, you know, not necessarily clear about why he's going to court. And, you know, they're targeting migrants who've been doing everything right since they got here. You know, they attend all their court dates. They spend thousands of dollars on all this paperwork and on lawyers that like to drag things out for extra money. There's a lot of stuff that they do to just try to make it to court at an extreme cost, only to have Homeland Security say, here's a notice to appear, show up in this court, they walk in, case dismissed, and next thing you know, they're in custody. And I know some migrants are trying to challenge that and not have their case dismissed in court, but so far I haven't heard of any cases where the judge is, you know, second-guessing that dismissal. You know, they have the memo from the DOJ And this is essentially the tactic that they're using. And unfortunately, a lot of judges are falling in line. We see the same thing with cops, you know, even in cities like, for example, here in Houston, our police department isn't supposed to be helping ICE do anything. But, you know, just recently, a lady called the cops for a domestic violence call, and they took her, called ICE, and took her into custody because she was, quote unquote, undocumented. So what message does that send to people? You know, from the DOJ notices to appear, if you get one in the mail and you know they're going to, you know, throw your case out, what's the incentive to show up to court if you know they're already going to, you know, take you into custody? So they're doing these things on purpose. It's just like the whole, when you try to use cruelty as a deterrent at the border, right? And you try to lock down the border and you try to make claiming asylum harder, people are going to end up going alternate routes, right? So you create this situation where now you have more known gotaways. And all of a sudden, now the far right has this narrative about, look at them, they're not even trying to do it the right way. This is going to be the same
thing. There's the catch 22.
Right. This is what's going to happen here with the court. We already know that, you know, upwards of 90% of migrants attend all their hearings and all their court dates. This is all very well documented. That number is going to drop significantly when they start realizing that, man, I spent tens of thousands of dollars and all this time and all this effort, and they're just going to throw me in jail anyway. Screw that. I'm not going. Now, all of a sudden, they're going to be able to point to the numbers and say, look, they don't show up to court either. And again, there's your catch 22. And for a migrant, the situation is go to court, get arrested. Don't go to court, get arrested. Okay. If you go to court, you're going to immediately be separated from your family. There's going to be all this chaos. Your family's not going to know what to do. Nobody's going to know where you are. You don't go to court, it buys you time to get your affairs in order before you either turn yourself in or just leave. These are the options migrants are being faced with. If they don't go to court, then they're now they have a failure to appear in addition to their civil penalties and all this other stuff. So they're creating this environment where it just makes it easy to manipulate the system. And I mean, we are talking about Homeland Security, right? The Homeland Security Act granted them powers no other agency has. So they can do stuff like this. They can tell the DOJ to tell their judges to start doing something in civil court about these immigration things. And that will get passed down because DHS is essentially in control of that situation. Revoking temporary protected status, you know, same thing. A lot of these migrants are going to, either they were already on TPS and applied for asylum, or they're going to apply for asylum afterwards, after the TPS gets revoked. I mean, they have 60 days after the announcement. So everybody's going to flood in to apply for asylum. Most of those people are going to end up in a court somewhere. Chances are, under this president, going to court is going to get you deported. So, you know, you have these situations where they revoke TPS for Venezuela or for people in Sudan, and they say
Haiti,
it's safe to go. They just did it to Haiti. It's safe to go back. But in the same document that Noam filed in the Federal Register, it talks about why Haiti is not safe to go back to. Yet in her press release and in the announcement, she says it's safe. And the incompetence in this administration, and I think I've said this before on here, is what makes them so dangerous. Because not only do they not understand the law, even if they did, they wouldn't care. But their outright incompetence and just ignorance is doing so much more harm than if somebody with some brains was in there. And it's just, yeah, the whole thing, it's all a setup. You know, right now there's over, if you count all the Cubans and Venezuelans and Nicaraguans and Haitians, and then this last order that kicks off 300 and something thousand, you're over a million people who have been kicked off of TPS this year. And they're all targets now. They're all targets. And that they're all Latino is not an accident, you know? So it's obvious what's going on here. And it's obvious what the motivations are. But I don't know that people are really understanding the level of just corruption, of a corruption of the system. They have bastardized everything about the immigration process all the way up to the Department of Justice. And now they're weaponizing the Department of Justice against judges, against law firms, against universities. So they have corrupted every part of this system. And when you see how easily all these people fall in line from the high-ranking people in the DOJ to the lowest man on the totem pole who got pulled off his desk at the IRS to go do ICE raids, they are all willingly doing it. So some of these folks, they may hate Trump, but they don't hate his policies so much. You see that in across a few issues with the bombing of Iran. You know, you saw that some Democrats didn't like how he went about it, but didn't denounce the bombing, you know, so it's not, they hated him for doing it the way he did, but they didn't hate that he did it. See?
Yeah. I just want to take this moment to reiterate something that you mentioned earlier, which is that the whole process to getting U.S. citizenship, and this isn't mentioned very often, it costs money. A lot of these asylum seekers and immigrants are spending money, hard-earned money, for their citizenship through the court process. And now it's being basically flushed down the toilet because of these raids that have gone viral in various social media outlets. In other words, it's flushing the hard work of both immigration lawyers and asylum lawyers down the toilet, essentially. And that doesn't even mention the fact that I think in your June 12th article, which is the one I am highlighting here right now, also mentions the issue of AI. I mean, the very idea of AI by itself is scary to be used in this whole deportation process. But you don't need AI necessarily to understand that immigration officials are really looking out for last names like Dominguez and Fernandez and names similar to ours. You know, you don't need AI to do that because there's no ambiguity there as far as who they're seeking out. Now, as if things couldn't get any worse, last month the Supreme Court ruled along political lines that lower court judges will no longer have the power to issue nationwide injunctions, not even to stop the president from taking illegal actions. You sort of alluded to this already. At the heart of this ruling is the Trump administration's attempt to end birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment. I want to ask you about this issue in two components. What do you make of this ruling as Arturo Dominguez, the journalist, and then Arturo Dominguez, the person? Because I know, having spoken with you several times on the show, much like myself as well, we have mixed status families. We have family members that came from different other countries apart from our immediate family's country of origin. It affects all sorts of families in a litany of ways that this current administration either doesn't put into mind or just doesn't care at all. And the Supreme Court seems to be going along with them down this white nationalist path.
From the journalist's perspective, the decision was based on nationwide injunctions. The only thing it had to do with birthright citizenship was that, just because that was the issue that brought it up. The ruling, you know, despite some of the headlines you might read, didn't do anything for or against birthright citizenship. It's just a matter of how lower courts make their decisions, like if, or how the, I should say, how the organizations like, you know, the ACLUs and stuff need to file their cases. And they, you know, in the decision, Amy Coney Barrett and Sotomayor kind of gave some guidance on how to do it to make sure you can get nationwide injunctions. But they, you know, they basically just handed the cases back down to the lower courts and kicked the can down the road on the birthright citizenship thing. The decision didn't allow Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship to take effect right away. They have 30 days to come up with a decision. The lower courts do, to figure out what they're going to do. But CASA and a couple of other immigrant rights groups have amended their cases to file class action cases so that they do have nationwide injunctions. And all the federal courts currently, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, all have pending cases regarding birthright citizenship, well, regarding Trump's executive order. On a personal note, the decision's scary as hell. You know, I know that according to Trump's order, that basically it was going to take effect 30 days after he signed it. And that was essentially no more birthright citizenship after that day. So according to that order, you know, I'm fine, right? Because I was born in the 70s here. But you know, they could take it as far back as they want. You know what I mean? If the Supreme Court allows this to stick. Ultimately, I don't think they do, but it's a crapshoot with this court. You know, historically, anytime anybody's tried to go after the 14th, they failed, just because the way it's written is very clear, almost in lay terms, you know, just very basically all persons, you know, born in the U.S. essentially have citizenship because you're born here. So I don't know where they're going with this. What bothers me is that now that the Supreme Court's off for a little while, this is where all the people can get in there and start trying to politic with the judges, essentially lobby them and give them all these weird justifications. Because you hear some of the justifications from Supreme Court justices and you're like, that doesn't make any sense. Where did that come from? It's because some lobbyist or some guy like, what's his name, Harlan Crow, throwing money at Clarence Thomas or whatever. Yeah, it's where we're at now with the birthright citizenship. Like I said, it's scary. I have a lot of cousins, a lot of families, nieces, nephews, all that stuff that were born here to, you know, family from Cuba or Jamaica or what have you. And, you know, it's alarming. You know, a memo came out on the 30th about denaturalizing, like taking citizenship away from naturalized citizens. And that's scary. You know, my parents are naturalized citizens. You know, I know a lot of people that are naturalized citizens whose kids were born here. So where does this end, right? It could affect me. It could affect my neighbors. Exactly. Right. Where does it end? And unless the Supreme Court really steps in and does something to stop this, I don't know who else can. And that's the scariest part.
Yes, that's what's scary. First of all, what's scary is the thought that this issue is even being raised in the first place. And two, as you mentioned, you know, if you being born in the U.S. doesn't make you a U.S. citizen, what does? How far do you have to go in one person or in one family's lineage to determine whether they are U.S. citizens or not? Do we have to go back all the way to the 1800s during the time of slavery to determine whether somebody is a U.S. citizen or not? My mom is documented when she came to this country, but my father was not. So am I a U.S. citizen or am I not? It's not like you could physically split me in half and split the difference. So it's a Pandora's box that is going to make one thing clear: disenfranchise millions of people of color with names such as yours and mine's and many other people whose names don't look or sound quote unquote American. And so we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
I'm the man. name's businessman with chronic heart disease. I'm another teenage suicide in a street that has no trees.
I am the one in tech,
and I'm on a leave.
I am the one in tech,
even though I don't exist.
Nobody knows me,
but I'm always there.
Statistic, a reminder of a world that doesn't care.
Third world mother, refugee without a home. My housewife in Stan Valley, and I'm a pensioner alone. My cancer ridden spectre that's covering the earth. I'm another hungry baby, yeah. An accident of birth.
I am the one in tech,
and I'm on a leave.
I am the one in tech,
even though I don't exist.
Nobody knows me,
but I'm always there.
Statistic, a reminder of the world.
That was UB40, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about migrants at the mercy of white nationalists with freelance writer Arturo Dominguez, who's based in Houston, Texas. So the last time we spoke, Arturo, I asked you about whether or not we are beyond the pretense of referring to ICE actions as arrests and deportations, but rather straight up say disappearances. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So following the Supreme Court ruling that we discussed in the first half of the show that could perhaps put birthright citizenship in danger, are we beyond the point of the notion that the Supreme Court is above the political fray and recognize it as an extension to Trump's white nationalist agenda? Because one of the things that frustrates me about CNN and MSNBC or the Washington Post or the New York Times is this presumption, this unspoken presumption that the Supreme Court justices are monks, or that the Supreme Court itself is a monastery, and that they are pure in their rulings and in their beliefs or what have you. No, they are politicians just like anyone else in the House or in the Senate. And so we should have gotten rid of this notion after the Roe v. Wade decision several years ago of overturning it. And now the very thought of ending birthright citizenship, I agree with you that it doesn't seem like it's likely going to happen. But the thought that it's even being proposed by this administration with this Supreme Court just throws the Supreme Court, in my opinion, flush down the toilet as far as its credibility.
Yeah. So, you know, I had a friend of mine who's a lawyer. He's old school guy for civil rights days. And he was telling me about, explaining to me how, you know, a lot of people see the Supreme Court as a chaos agent. You know, one time they'll rule this and then they'll rule that and then they'll go back to this. And essentially, his assertion is that by ruling on the injunction and not the executive order, the Supreme Court is intentionally being a chaos agent. Because his argument is, had they just stepped up and shut down what is constitutionally true, this conversation would have ended months ago. But the fact that they're still not made a decision, and they had just took off for however long they take off for, and they're just going to kick the can down the road and keep it as it is right now with all this chaos, just goes to show that their true purpose isn't to, you know, decipher and interpret the Constitution, but to manipulate it in ways that create chaos. And we went through a lot of cases going all the way back to Dred Scott. He kept talking about all these different things. And when you go back to Dred Scott and you go back, you come now and you look at all the stuff in between, he's right. There are very few things that the Supreme Court upholds for any length of time. Birthright citizenship is one of those rare occasions where for over 150 years, it is what it is, because the Constitution is worded like it's for, you know, a third grader. Anybody can understand what they meant with the 14th Amendment. It's very clear. So his argument is that since they can't, they know that they won't be able to rule against the 14th, they're just going to maintain the chaos for as long as possible for Trump. And like, you know, the Supreme Court, like you were saying, there is no infinite wisdom that any one of them possess, right? They're not any smarter than the next guy, really. They're political. Everything about the Supreme Court is political, always has been. You look at the, go back to Dred Scott again, that was very political, attacking the Voting Rights Act and stripping it. That was 100% political. All the attempts at taking down Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act, they've been successful here and there, but overall they've taken a lot of L's, but it's all been political. You know, the Supreme Court, at this point, when it comes to Obamacare, if they rule against Obamacare, they're about to put a lot of people without health insurance and with no guardrails as far as to how much insurance can cost them. So, you know, you can't just toss out the marketplace like that. So, yeah, you know, with it, with this case and just the Supreme Court in general, you talked about Roe. I mentioned the Voting Rights Act. This is what they do. You know, they interpret it in their own political way. Some of them, like Clarence Thomas, is obvious, are making decisions based on financial contributions, hanging out with billionaires and getting tour buses and things like that handed to you. So, yeah, you know, I've never put much weight into the Supreme Court, and I always hold my breath when it's the Supreme Court, because no matter, like Roe, you know, you would think they all said it in Congress that it's, you know, it's the law of the land, we're not going to touch it. And every one of them went in and voted to overturn it. So, yeah, it's political, everything.
Absolutely. You know, for some reason, I have to tell you this, but in the 19-year history of this show, we've only done a show once on Australia and the small Latino population in Australia. And when I did that show, one of the things that came up in my research was what was called the White Australia Policy, which created the population, the majority white population in Australia that we see right now. It wasn't by accident. It was certainly by design. And so while things may have changed in Australia in recent times, I would encourage people to Google the White Australia Policy of the 20th century, because it's food for thought as to what direction this particular Trump administration, hand in hand with the Supreme Court, might be taking the country to. And that's no exaggeration, in my opinion. That's no joke at all. It's quite scary for people of color, such as myself and my guests. So the majority of the viral videos of ICE officials that we've seen detaining and disappearing people have a lot of agents wearing masks to conceal their identity. I want to get your thoughts on both politicians and activists raising more awareness to this problem. That was certainly the case over in Los Angeles, especially when, you know, people were uprising last month with regards to a series of ICE raids. And you can see in almost all these viral videos, ICE agents are wearing masks. I want to get your thoughts on this.
Well, you know, the masks created a lot of conspiracy theories. There's a lot of weird stuff happening. And I talked to former agents and a former legal analyst who worked for ICE. And there's a lot of people from the agency, Homeland Security and stuff, that think they're doing this on purpose. They want violence to happen. I've heard from some cops that they've overheard ICE agents say that they're ready to go loud. Go loud means fire, open guns, you know, shoot at people. Mm. And that's a scary thing. The cops that told me that seemed pretty shook by it. So, yeah, the mask thing is really bad news, really bad news. Okay, so it's causing a lot of panic and fear in our communities, right? There's this conspiracy theory online right now saying that January Sixers and Proud Boys are working with ICE. That's why these guys look so unprofessional. That's why they're dressed this way. That's why they're wearing masks. I try to explain to people that, look, I know you don't believe ICE would ever act this way, but this is what they do. They brutalize people. There is no accountability for ICE. Never has been, never will be. until something drastically changes. People remain convinced that there's January Sixers and Proud Boys out there doing this. Now, they're not working with ICE, but there are plenty of cases of people dressing up as ICE because you can buy all their gear on Amazon. They put on a mask and sexually assault women. It happened in New York City. Just a week ago here in Houston, a guy tried to rob somebody in an ICE uniform and wasn't successful, but he kicked dude's door down in full-blown ICE gear, wearing a mask. Homeowner can't tell if that's an ICE agent or not. Shoot or don't shoot. So that's the situation we're in.
Can I just remind the audience as well that we had this incident over in Minnesota last month where somebody was impersonating law enforcement and killed a local government politician in the state of Minnesota. So it may not have anything to do with ICE, but this is the problem with wearing masks by ICE agents that, as you just mentioned, gives people sort of the green light, if not, you know, an open invitation to imitate law enforcement, and people may not have a way to figure out whether it's ICE or not. This is the problem of law enforcement wearing masks. And this is a separate conversation that can ask an hour long in and of itself, much like the same way the last time we spoke with the issue of tattoos in racially profiling people of color as well. So on more positive news, because we have to get as much positive news as much as we can in these days, Columbia University graduate and Palestinian student protest leader Mahmoud Khalil was reunited with his wife and newborn son last month after being released on bail by a federal judge following over 100 days in a Louisiana ICE jail. Here's a clip of Mahmoud Khalil on MSNBC last month describing his detention and the conditions in the prison. Let's take a listen.
The moment you enter these facilities, or not even that, the moment that ICE apprehend you, you don't have any rights. You're expected to follow orders, not to know anything. And when they tell you to sign papers that you should sign, otherwise they would leave you in a room for a couple of hours, and then like they would come and ask you like to sign these papers. Inside the detention, the situation was sort of like dire in terms of like I shared a dorm with at least 70 other men. Very difficult stories. You would hear like just heart-wrenching stories about individuals who have been in this country undocumented, but that's their only offense. Like, they didn't do anything wrong. Some of them were picked up from their court hearings, from their ICE check-ins. And that's to a lot of people is just like so confusing, because they said like, we were in the process of getting documentation, why we are being thrown here. And once again, no matter what the conditions are in such facilities, it's not necessary. Like, even if you had the best conditions, and being separated from my family. There was one individual literally attended his father's funeral on the phone. And he had to request like from 70 people to be silent for at least 20 minutes so he can attend the service.
So again, that was Mahmoud Khalil on MSNBC describing his detention and the conditions in the Louisiana ICE jail last month. And I was critical of MSNBC. I still am. But in this instance, they did a pretty good job with this interview here. And there's a lot to process in that one clip of Mahmoud Khalil alone. I mean, the idea of ICE agents forcing migrants to fill out papers that they don't want to fill out is problematic in and of itself. The idea of 70 people into one cell at a time is dangerous, to say the least. But yeah, I want to get your thoughts on this, because again, there's a lot to process in his description of this ICE jail in Louisiana.
Yeah, so that story doesn't ever get any easier. I've heard that several times, and it's just as difficult each time, because I've heard these stories about these overcrowded cells. You know, a couple months ago, I did that article with the videos from the Chrome Detention Center in Miami. You know,
that's right.
These places here in Louisiana and in Texas, they're no punk. They are worse than some of our prisons. You know, the overcrowding is just tremendous. Right, like right now, the population, the ICE detention population is pushing 60,000. They're only equipped to handle like 42. So they're currently using that narrative to justify giving ICE, you know, $75 billion over the next 4 years. Because, you know, oh, look at just how underfunded they are. Before Trump, they had less than half their beds filled. So, you know, it's not a look how underfunded they are and how much need they have. The situation, though, especially in Louisiana, like what he described is terrifying. You know, 70 people in one dorm area. You know, it made me think of the 75-year-old Cuban man who died in Chrome Detention Center, marking the 13th death since Trump took office. You know, that's a shame. That's a shame. What threat is a 75-year-old man that he has to be incarcerated? A guy like that could sit at home with his ankle monitor on until it's time to go. A guy like that shouldn't have to go. He's 75. He lived for decades here. What is sending him back to Cuba going to do? Nothing. He died in detention. And, you know, Tom Homan was asked about it, and his response is, people die in jail all the time. People die here all the time. People die there all the time. He's like, what about all the lives we saved? Was that 75-year-old man a serial killer and I'm not aware? Like, what are you talking about? That 75-year-old man didn't harm anybody. What Mahmoud Khalil was talking about right there, when he says that they're in there for nothing more than being undocumented, they are in there for a civil penalty, right? Punishable by a fine and possible deportation, not incarceration in some inhumane building with a lack of food, lack of health care, you know, no clothing, no bed to sleep on, no blankets. Like, this is, do we have more laws in this country to protect livestock than we do immigrants? And it's ridiculous to see what they're putting these people through, and to see somebody like Tom Homan or Stephen Miller just laugh it off, like, oh, you know, people die in jail all
white nationalists.
Right, right. They don't, I assure you that one day it's going to come out that they were laughing about all of this, that they were laughing about every death, about every child crying, about every family separation. It's going to come out one day that they were laughing about this. You see it in Miller's face. You see it in Homan's face. They get off on it.
That's a bad picture to think of right there.
Yeah, right, right.
So, yeah, I mean, not to mention the fact that ProPublica a few years ago caught ICE agents on a secret Facebook chat, mm-hmm. you know, expressing white nationalist views to migrants that died in ICE detention. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility, because it's happened during the first Trump administration. So we have about a few minutes left. And as a means to try to end this conversation on, again, a positive note, here is another clip of Mahmoud Khalil speaking to MSNBC about carrying on his political activism in spite of his detention and in spite of his uncertain future. Let's take a listen.
I don't think there's a choice where your people are being slaughtered by the day, that you would remain silent or not. It's very uncomfortable. It's very risky. But also the moral price I would pay if I remain silent, I believe it's much higher. That's why I don't consider that now, well, like, I'm out, let me go about my life. Because unfortunately, my life is rooted in fighting this injustice. And I can't imagine myself just remaining silent while bombs are being thrown on the heads of my people.
So on the first clip that I played of Mahmoud Khalil, he spoke about the horrendous conditions and the tragic stories that he heard in the ICE detention that he was at in Louisiana. In spite of all that, as you heard from that clip right now, he still has the will and the determination to carry on his political activism in the name of social justice, in the name of his people, his Palestinian people, to speak out at the risk of his own future. You know, that is a determination and perseverance that I not only see in Mahmoud Khalil, the individual, but also the people who tried sincerely to fight the good fight and went out to the No Canes demonstrations from last month. And so I bring that up because it is an expression of perseverance that I want to share both with you and with the WPFW audience that's listening to us. Because I guess my question to you, for lack of anything else, is do you see the same determination in your line of work? Because I certainly see that in what Mahmoud said. And while he may be talking about Palestinian rights, people who went out to the No Kings demonstrations saw the same parallels, the same reasons to be out there determined to put, you know, your beliefs with regards to social justice out there in spite of whatever uncertain future we're all facing as people of color. Do you see the same determination in your line of work?
I do. You know, I see that when I feel it when I speak up for the Cuban people on the island more than anything else. I do feel it when, you know, when I'm working with Dr. Gaines. You know, she's a Black scholar. I've known her for several years. We work together and I feel that same passion. Mahmoud Khalil is a brave, brave son of a bitch. All of us can say that if we went through what he did, we would still be on it and like him. But I'm not so sure everybody would. It's not only a scary situation to be in because of where you are. It's a scary situation to be in because of who put you there and why they put you there. And they put him there for speaking up. Make no mistake, this wasn't about he's a threat to national security or anything like that, because he isn't, obviously. It's a free speech issue. I refuse to be deterred from what I do, even under, you know, during Biden and Trump before that. And, you know, when I get pushback from people at the State Department or something like that, it doesn't bother me. I've been in the Harris County jail. Where are they going to put me back in there? Like, I just laughed about it in that regard. But yeah, you know, it's some things are bigger than us, you know, fighting for my family, fighting for Black rights for my family, for my nieces and nephews, for my cousins and uncles and all that stuff, for the freedom to travel from Cuba to the U.S. and back and forth. All that stuff is bigger than me. When I speak up for Cubans, I speak up because there's 11 million people on that island that are being put through something they shouldn't have to be put through. They're essentially prisoners for no reason other than just being Cuban and being supportive of their government. It's pretty shameful to live in a country that I love. I love this country. I love my people in this country, but I'm not necessarily proud of it right now. You know, I'm not.
None of us are.
Yeah. I don't know that anybody can be. That doesn't make me any.
Because again, it's being run by white nationalists. There's right. No ambiguity about it. There's right. No vagueness about it. It's run by white nationalists. And the more we say that in these platforms or in these avenues, like the ones that we navigate over the years, you know, hopefully it'll get to people's minds that, hey, we have to do something about this. What that is, we don't know. And that is the real challenge when it comes to grassroots activism. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. Like I said before, Arturo's been a very busy guy the last couple of weeks with so many articles on his Substack page. The one I would highlight is his June 12th article entitled How the White House is Setting Migrants Up for Detention. And as always, it's been informative. It's been insightful. Arturo Dominguez, thank you very much again for being on the show with us.
Man, I appreciate you having me on here as always, Oscar. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. I want to remind everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Federal immigration agents were met with a strong show of resistance yesterday when they raided two farms in Southern California. Hundreds of community members were on site to protest as ICE agents, accompanied by National Guard troops in military-style vehicles, turned up at the two locations. One local television station reported that tear gas was fired at crowds during the encounter. The incident comes as federal immigration enforcement agents have ramped up arrests in Southern California. The Trump administration has had the National Guard providing protection for federal immigration agents carrying out the raids, and this week it sent a large caravan with guns and horses to MacArthur Park in Los Angeles. In other news, President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump are in Texas today to see firsthand the aftermath of the catastrophic 4th of July flash flooding that has left at least 120 people dead. The visit comes amid questions about the future of FEMA and its functioning as the disaster in Texas unfolded. For months, President Trump and his Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, have said that FEMA could be eliminated. But now administration officials say abolishing the agency outright is not on the agenda. There has also been reporting that FEMA's response in Texas was delayed due to a new rule that Secretary Noem must sign off on any contract or grant that exceeds $100,000. CNN reports Noem didn't authorize urban search and rescue teams' deployment until Monday, more than 72 hours after the flash flood. In more news, the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights reported today that nearly 800 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in Gaza since late May while attempting to access humanitarian aid. Most of the killings were reported near aid distribution centers run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, while others took place along aid convoy routes. The GHF uses private U.S. security and logistics companies to get supplies into Gaza, largely bypassing a UN-led system. The UN has called the plan inherently unsafe and a violation of humanitarian impartiality rules. The GHF has denied that fatal shootings have occurred in the immediate vicinity of its aid points. And a story in the New York Times reports that the FBI is using polygraph tests on its own employees to gauge their loyalty to the administration. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
The use of these polygraph tests, informally known as lie detector tests, comes at the behest of FBI Director Kash Patel. Patel has unleashed a wave of internal reviews designed to remove those ideologically opposed